doesn't know, the interviewer is Clark Hansen from the Oregon Historical Society. The date is 1/30/1998, and this is tape 8, side 1. When we left off, we were talking about events leading up to World War II. You had just said a moment ago that you remembered the dignitary that came to visit. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could...
His name was Edier. Edier, and we always put a sama after that. And I think that, if you remember right, that he was in charge of the Uta Dokoro. That was the poetry making that they did in the Imperial Palace.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Huh.
Last night I remembered the name.
I see, uh-huh. I see. So then he actually lived or worked at the Imperial Palace?
I'm sure. I'm sure, uh-huh. Mm. But he was one of the peer group. And I mentioned to you that he was a very dignified, very handsome, very yes. tall Japanese.
Yes, yes. Well, just as we were finishing last night, we were talking about the... some of the events that were happening in your life right before World War II. And one of the things that you did mention was that that your first child, your son, had died after mm-hmm. he was a year and a half old. Mm-hmm. Then you mentioned after the tape ran out that you blamed yourself for your son's death.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Could you explain why you felt that way?
Well, it was the time when sort of an epidemic had started out in Okayama, and we thought that it probably was due to the mosquitoes. And there was a pond behind our house that was quite a huge pond with lotus plants. Mm-hmm. And this one evening, my husband was gone to visit his friends, and I did want to do some shopping at the department store, so I left Kazuhiko in the bed with the big mosquito netting. You probably aren't aware of the mosquito netting, but it just covers the whole room. Mm-hmm. And I heard he went to the department store and came back and found him crying, and he was out of the net and looking for me. And it was probably the second day after that he came down with a fever, and this is what, and he had encephalitis, as I had told you, but I had always blamed myself for having gone out and having left him. And so after he died, I did make a promise to myself, and that if ever there was anything unhappy that happened in my life, I would bear that and compensate for that. So it was a sad time of my life, because I felt that because I had unhappy thoughts with my husband and the way we were living, that this was the punishment that I had. And I remember that clearly. Hmm.
Did you ever tell your husband that?
No.
Did you tell anyone else?
No, I never have.
Yeah, yeah. How do you feel about it now with so many years that have passed?
Oh, I have reconciled, and I try to forget that. Mm-hmm. But life has to go on, you know.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
I do remember, though, when we took him into the hospital, the doctors were very, very kind, and they really worked hard because they themselves didn't know what the sleeping sickness was, and so they did many tests on him. And another interesting part of that incident is that they felt that the breastfed milk was the best for him, and so the young teachers under my husband took their milk and used to bring it to the hospital for Kazuhiko.
Really?
But he was unconscious all the time that he was in the hospital, and I think probably about a week he died.
What kind of, in general, what kind of funeral services do the Japanese have for their loved ones?
Well, at that time, all I can remember is that we brought him out into the outskirts of Okayama, and I really don't know, but he was cremated. Mm-hmm. And the following morning, we went there and took these ashes and the bones from the it's probably what you call it, is it B-R-I-E or Briar? It's like the Indians, that they cremate the body, mm-hmm. you know.
Yes.
And then afterwards they'll pick their bones or whatever, and that's mm-hmm. the way we did it, and we put it in a small urn.
Yes.
But there's what you call a nodo botoke, and there's a little bone in the, I would imagine you call it the esophagus, that has the form of Buddha, hmm. part of Buddha. And that is one of the bones that we were told to pick up by me. We got the bones and the ashes.
I see.
And he was cremated in the Dozono family plot in Kyushu.
And that's where he is today?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the things that we were talking about just before that, how would you describe the level and the expression of patriotism by the Japanese during the 1930s and leading up to the beginning of World War II? How did they express their patriotism?
I mentioned to you before that when we went to the big national shrines, or even going in front of the mm-hmm. the palace, that we were told to bow,
yes.
and that was the way that we respected the emperor. And so at that time, I would imagine that they really did think that he was a national god. Mm-hmm. If you go through the history of Japan, they're the two gods that started the whole making of the island. And so from way back, more than 2,000 years ago, they really thought that the emperor was a divine being. And so what he said was the Almighty. But actually, when you read the history, he is actually a puppet. He does not give voice. There's a group of people who give him counsel, but he actually is not the person that decides all of these things. And you understand that even after the World War II, that mm-hmm. he was more of a puppet and not the soothsayer.
And who was running the country then at the time?
Well, I'm sure it would be like a council of people, like mm-hmm. like the Senate or the peer group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
if you start asking me about the history,
right?
Yeah, it's going to be very
difficult.
Hard because especially the women did not know, mm-hmm. and there was not that much in the newspapers, mm-hmm. and so we just, as I've continued to mention to you, that
right.
that the woman's place was in the home, and we had nothing to do with politics or whatever.
But did you ever see people just in your village or just within your family express their feeling of patriotism?
No, it was just a natural thing.
And you said that you didn't really hear much about the war that was going on in China or Manchuria.
Right, right. But I do remember, though, that there was one time before Keiko was born, and we opened our homes to the soldiers who were going to war, and there were two young men who stayed at my house, at our house, for 2 days, and both were farmers. And since they were staying at our house for 2 days, I suggested that they invite their wives so that they could stay for the night, and one was a tall, very humorous young man, and he immediately called and made arrangements to have his wife come, and they both stayed at our house. And the other one was smaller, but he was a very serious person, and he said, once I leave my home, I'm giving my life to the country. And so I said my goodbyes at home, and so I don't want to see my wife. And that I remember very well, because he was such a serious person. And the sad thing about it is the serious man was killed, and the humorous person did come back. And he came back to thank us for the things that we had done for him. But that remained in my memory too. The Japanese were so loyal that once they intended to go to war, they would actually give up their lives. And so they didn't want to have any softness. They didn't want to show the softness in their hearts, and so that was it.
How did that make you feel?
Well, that was a natural thing. It's hard to explain, because that was the way life was in Japan, and so you took everything as it was without any question. But my husband always did say that country came first, and then family. Within the family, children came first, and the wife came last. And I used to laugh at him, and I said, well, you know. But I think, actually, to be honest, I think that's what he felt. Uh-huh. That's the way the history of Japan was, that the children were revered because they were the people who took after you, and the wife was the least of the in that family structure.
You had mentioned yesterday that at one point you had seen German acrobats performing.
Yes.
And how amazing it was to people to watch these people. How did people in Japan feel about the Germans, especially their concept of racial purity and the superior race and things like that?
Well, I'm sure they didn't talk too much about racial superiority, but I'm sure that they wanted to show how great the Germans were. And so there's a long history between Japan and the German people. I think I mentioned to you before that most of the medicine that was studied came from Germany. And so they always felt that the German people were very industrious, hardworking, very honest people. And so I think they really respected the German race.
And then Germany was allied with Japan then during this period of time too. Was there any, did you hear people expressing any feeling about that?
I don't think so.
You had mentioned about this one cousin of yours that had been imprisoned, and that he had expressed certain dissent and disagreement with the government, and it was unusual then for people to openly dissent.
Exactly. And he never talked politics to me. He never told me what was going on, because he didn't want to incriminate me. And so when he came, it was a very hush-hush thing. And I'm sure that people, you wouldn't call them Gestapos, because that's Germany, but the people were very aware of wherever he went. And so he was very careful of what he did and what he said when he was at our house.
And in the media or among friends, anywhere, did you ever hear any dissent in those areas about or disagreement with what the government was doing, or
no.
And were you communicating at all with your family in Oregon about anything that was going on
during the war?
Before the war.
Oh yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did they ever express any feelings about what was happening politically or militarily?
No. Uh-huh. They never did. In fact, they never even talked about the Depression.
Hmm. So what kinds of things were they talking about then when you would communicate?
About family.
Now, one thing that was interesting that you said yesterday was that you had decided at a certain point that you were not going back to Japan, or not going back to America.
Mm-hmm.
So, were you talking with other members in your family, particularly your father, about his coming over?
No. Mm-hmm. It was just a known thing that he was going to come over.
Mm-hmm.
But when, that was another problem.
And
I must tell you, though, during the first part of my life, and even in the latter part of my life, my father had a beautiful handwriting, and it was very archaic.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a hard time understanding, even with my knowledge of Japanese. And so it was always my aunt who had to translate when I first got the letters. And that's when I first went over there. That's when he said, please forget family and your sisters and family, and concentrate on your studies, because one of these days we will be over there to be with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the gist of the letters. And so even after I was married, when my father wrote letters, my husband had to. I could read part of it, but there were some parts that I couldn't understand.
It was that difficult.
Uh-huh. I would like to mention, of course, you not knowing the Japanese language, but it would be like gozaimasu. Instead of gozaimasu, it would be like soro.
Hmm. Very different.
Very, very different. Very different, very formal. And when I was going through some of my things that I wanted to show you yesterday, I came upon a letter that my husband had sent me when I was working for the ABCC in Hiroshima. And he said, I think this is a letter that you had kept from your mother. And so I have a letter that was written to me by my mother. And it's also not as refined as my father, but it was also very archaic.
Hmm.
And so I knew that, you know, she was also well-educated as far as the women were concerned, and I have kept that.
And you hadn't realized that up until then?
Well, I knew that I had it, but I had forgotten that I had kept it.
Right.
And so he sent it to me, and I still have that. Yeah. In that letter, she had written saying that she was sending me some clothes and some sweets.
Was the spoken language also as much different between the? Was there like an archaic spoken language as well as a more modern spoken language?
No.
So it was only in writing.
In writing.
Uh-huh.
Even today, when we write letters, even to my friends, I would say like Machiko-sama. And ogenki desu ka? There's a lot of formality in a letter, even if we're friends.
Mm-hmm. So people still use the formal language today, in places.
In writing. Not as much.
Not as much.
No.
Uh-huh. Do younger people use it at all?
I laugh because some of my letters, the younger people cannot write it, read it. Because they say that my writing is difficult. I learned the I guess the only thing you can say is cursive, but it's a relaxed type of writing the kanji. Mm-hmm. And so it's not as stiff as a regular kanji, but it's more of a cursive. And they say that's very difficult for to read. But I have been praised by many people that I have a good Japanese writing, handwriting.
Did you have any idea that war would break out with Japan?
Not at all.
The United States?
Not at all.
And as it was approaching the war, was there any chance that your husband would be called for military duty?
No. Mm-hmm. No, he would not be called because of his age and because of his position. But because of his position and the status that he had, he was actually the head of the boys' students' organization in the whole of Okayama Prefecture. Mm-hmm. And that was the downfall. That was one of the reasons why he was purged at the end of the war, because every person who had anything to do with the military, they were purged. And that to me was a very sad thing, because people who did not want to have anything to do with the Japanese government or were nilly-willy, because they were the silent people, they got the better jobs after the war. And it's a sad situation. And when you think about even an American being patriotic, mm-hmm. you know that he has a patriotic spirit and that he has something within himself to give to the government. Mm-hmm. They are called loyalists. Mm-hmm. And so whenever there is anything that's happening between either countries or whatever, they will speak out and not just stand back. Those are the people that were caught, and those are the people who were purged.
Well,
so there's a lot to learn in war.
A lot of things happen in war that are don't conform to logic,
right,
or
right,
rationality.
Right.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk more about this when the war concludes. But when did you first hear about Pearl Harbor then?
Actually, we didn't hear about Pearl Harbor. We just heard that the war was going, that it was, war started.
And when was the first time you ever heard about Pearl Harbor then? The attack on Pearl Harbor?
Probably several days after. My husband probably knew, but I keep on telling you back again and again that women had nothing to do with politics mm-hmm. or didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. We just took whatever our husband said mm-hmm. and that was our life.
So how did you first feel then when you heard that there was a war between the United States and Japan?
Well, I argued a lot with my husband, and I said that the Japan will never win because the country is so different, and it's made up with so many different nationalities that they are a strong people. But he said, you're wrong. He said the Japanese will persevere, and they will persevere to the very end. And that was the way it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you were both right.
Right.
They did persevere to the very end.
Right.
But then, of course, the way the war concluded.
Exactly.
There was no other.
Well, we didn't talk about the war either, because it was a man's subject then, and we were never, you know, getting together and talking politics.
And was there any discussion in your village at all?
There could have been.
But with nothing that you were.
No.
Nothing that you were aware of. Do you feel that you were treated any differently because you were an American citizen?
No one knew. By that time, where we lived.
I see.
Going back, Keiko and Robert were born in Katsuyama, which was the first high school that my husband was transferred to as a principal of a high school. And then 3 years later, we were transferred over to Uno, Takamatsu, where Sho was born. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we were transferred over to another, a larger high school, which was in Takahashi. And that, they, of course, they're all in Okayama. But every time you're transferred, you transfer into a bigger high school. And when we were in Takahashi, that's when war ended. But by that time, everything was rationed. Rice was rationed, soy sauce was rationed, miso was rationed, sugar was rationed so much per person.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned how to make vinegar by gathering sort of spoiled persimmons. It was a mountainous area where we lived, and there were a lot of persimmons. And I would get up early in the morning and pick them before the farmers awoke, because it was almost like stealing. But they were all on the ground. And I would bring them back, and I would let it ferment in the sun, and made sort of a crazy type of vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And we all suffered during the war.
Did you have any communication with your family during the war?
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely not. No.
And not with the American Embassy?
No. Yeah. Well, American Embassy was not there, so, you know, when the war broke out, everything was just closed.
Right. Right. And were you, during the war, were you hearing anything about...
Well, we were winning. Every place we went, we were winning, 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 and nothing else was mm-hmm. talked about. And at that time, too, I remember that the boys, I never went to my husband's school because of raising the children, but I would hear stories about the gym being transferred into sort of a factory. And all the, I think after the war, we hear these things that most of the schools were changed from a place like gym were made into factories where they had to make things for the military people.
Mm-hmm.
And the rations were, we were told that we got the worst of whatever it was, like the potatoes that were the cold potatoes and, you know, that sort of thing. And everything went to the military, and of course that was what we call atarimai, that was natural, you know, because they were fighting to save our lives.
Did the high school that your husband supervised, did that high school, was that turned into a factory as well?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. How many students went to that high school?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't remember.
But it's fairly large.
It was, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, we had... several students. One in particular was a boy who came from a poor farm family, and they lived away from Takahashi, and his father was at war, and so the mother came and asked us if we could take care of this son so that he would be closer to school. And this goes back to the fact that my husband always said that if we're going to take care of anyone, we should take care of a poor family mm-hmm. who would be grateful for whatever we did for them. And so we did take care of this boy for several months, but I think in comparison to Shozo, the young boy that we had taken care of before mm-hmm. the war, this young student was from a very poor family, and I had the three children, and I know that I treated him exactly the same, if not better. But he, it could have been his character, but he always wanted more, and it was very sad, because I think he had a feeling of being neglected, and that he didn't get his rights. His father was at war, my husband was not at war, mm-hmm. and so he would steal food, you know, from the children. And it got to the point where we said, well, we just can't take care of him. But that shows that I think that it's in a person's character how you feel when you are in that sort of situation. Mm-hmm. I have not forgotten that, but there's another boy, Bunji Namba, who came, and he was a very strong, curly-haired young boy, and we always thought that he was an orphan. And he came, and at that time,